Welcome to New Books in Biography. I'm Oline Eaton. John Kennedy remains one of the most beguiling of all the American presidents, because of what he represents, but also because of what he had the potential to become. As Thurston Clark writes in the preface to his new biography, "More than most presidents, more than most middle-aged men, he was a work in progress, a moving target for anyone trying to capture him on a canvas or in prose." Today I'm going to be talking today with Thurston Clark about his impressions of the 35th President of the United States, as well as his new book entitled JFK's Last 100 Days, An Intimate Portrait of a Great President. Hi Thurston, thank you so much for joining us today for New Books in Biography. I wonder if you could kick things off just by telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I've written about 11 books. I started being a travel writer, and I also did some what I call microhistory. I did a book about the King David Hotel explosion, wrote that back in 1980. Recently, I've been doing mostly history instead of travel. I've done two other books about the Kennedy family, and I did a book about the Pearl Harbor attack that was published on the 50th anniversary in 1991.
So what drew you to JFK as a biographical subject and to this period of his life in particular?
Well, driven to JFK was that I am in the baby boom generation. I was 17 when he was assassinated. I was, after JFK, I was very involved in the civil rights movement in the South. So there was that. I first wrote about his inaugural address after hearing George W. Bush's inaugural address. Which wasn't, of course, was nowhere near as stirring. And that gave me the idea of writing a book about how the inaugural address was put together and what part Kennedy had in it. After that, I wrote a book about Bobby Kennedy's 1968 campaign. And my recent book, JFK's Last 100 Days, is the kind of third and last in that trilogy. I'm kind of moving on now. As for the 100 days, I knew that there were quite a few things that had happened. I mean, I knew about the Limited Test Ban Treaty, which was the first treaty to limit nuclear weapons since the beginning of the Cold War. And I knew that that had been signed then. But I didn't realize how much else was going on until I began to do some preliminary research, and that's what sold me on doing the book. I found out that at the time Kennedy was also trying to get a civil rights bill through Congress. And there was what I call a kind of the forgotten detente of John F. Kennedy, which was really kicked off by the Test Ban Treaty. But it involved a whole bunch of other things that went on in the last 100 days that led a number of people to believe, a lot of people at the UN ambassadors and others, to believe that we might be seeing what Sir Alec Douglas Hume, the Foreign Secretary of Great Britain, called the beginning of the end of the Cold War.
So what sources were most helpful to you in writing this?
What was helpful to me?
What sources?
Well, you would be surprised that there actually is new material that's come out about Kennedy in the last couple of years. I would say the most helpful sources, and also new sources, were the tapes that he made in the Oval Office in the Cabinet Room from 1962 until his death in November of 63. Other presidents have taped. But Kennedy, unlike Nixon, who just let the machine run on and on and on, Kennedy only activated these secret buttons that he had hidden under the desks when he thought something historically important or something politically noteworthy was happening. The reason he did this was that he was taping for two reasons. Most importantly for him was that he wanted to use this in his memoirs. Kennedy, he was a very competitive man, and very keen on having being remembered as a great president, and he thought part of that was writing great presidential memoirs. And so he would be the only one that would have this material, the actual conversations. He knew that his advisor, Arthur Schlesinger, who had won a Pulitzer Prize in history, would probably write about his administration, and probably also Ted Sorensen, his speechwriter and close advisor. But he wanted to be able to really beat them to the punch and have material they didn't have. And so he kept this taping system as secret from everyone except one or two very close advisors and his secretary. The other reason he wanted to tape was that he was upset that after the botched Bay of Pigs operation, the attempt to topple Castro in 1961, that was planned by Eisenhower, President Eisenhower, but approved by Kennedy. He was afraid that what was going to happen. Well, what happened after that was that a lot of his advisors, who had recommended going ahead with the operation, suddenly began to announce that actually they had counseled him to be more cautious and not to go right ahead. And so he wanted to have people on the record so they couldn't backtrack as they had after the Bay of Pigs. Now, the material from the tapes has been released slowly over the last, you know, I'd say 10 years or so by the Kennedy Library, but only in the last couple of years did they finally release the tapes of the last 6 months, and it's fascinating, particularly the tapes of Kennedy talking to Soviet Foreign Minister Gromyko and also Soviet Ambassador to Washington, Dobrynin. And in both cases, the Soviets are pushing him for more agreements and pushing this detente. And it's fascinating to hear the back and forth. And this is new information. So, first of all, there are these tapes. And the second thing that's new is that some of the material that's been kind of tied up by the Kennedy Library has been released, among them Jackie Kennedy's oral history, which wasn't supposed to be released for another 25 years or so. Caroline Kennedy allowed it to be released and published. Ted Sorensen, who has recently died, also published his memoirs with a lot of new material. So there was a lot for me to work with that hadn't yet been on the record. And also I can say that the oral histories in the Kennedy Library, there are over 500 of them. They're so extensive that you don't necessarily that some of the material has not been published before, not been referred to, used in a biography or a history.
Mm-hmm. So the book's subtitle is "An Intimate Portrait of a Great President." So I'm assuming that you think that JFK was a great president, but how?
That's the British subtitle. Yeah, the American subtitle talks about the emergence of a great president, which I think is a bit more accurate.
Yes.
And my position was that during these 100 days, we could see what kind of a president Kennedy was becoming, what kind of a president he was going to be had he lived. Mm-hmm. You see, Kennedy was a man who was constantly, more than most middle-aged men, more than most presidents, kind of a moving target. He was changing all the time. He was revising his positions. He was even when he was in office. And so, if you wanted to see who he would have been and the kind of man he would have been, I think you have to look at these last 100 days. Even more to the point, during the last 100 days, Kennedy had finally come to grips and was finally trying to resolve and solve the two really great threats to the United States and to the world. The first was to the United States and to the world, which was, of course, the danger of nuclear war. We'd almost had a nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 62. And the second, in the United States, was the danger of racial conflict. And finally, in 1963, after being very timid about civil rights, he sent a civil rights bill to Congress in the summer of 63, and also in the summer of 63, was the one who unilaterally called off American nuclear testing and sent negotiators to Moscow to negotiate a treaty banning nuclear testing, which resulted in the Limited Test Ban Treaty. So this was stuff that was all happening in his last 100 days. And so I say in the book, of course, we can't say for sure that Kennedy would have been a great president or what he would have done. But what we can say is what he intended to do. And he intended to settle the Cold War. He was on his way to doing that. Few people know now. They're quite surprised when I tell them that in the UN General Assembly in September of 63, Kennedy offered to call off the race to the moon with the Soviet Union and to send American and Soviet cosmonauts together to the moon, which was part of his détente, I mean, it was quite a thing and quite surprising, because we always think of Kennedy as being behind the space race, but if there was going to be a detente, if the Cold War was going to be over, what was the point of wasting a lot of money to beat the Soviets to the moon when a joint mission could kind of symbolize, you know, the two countries' emerging detente? Kennedy also planned to go to Moscow in the winter of 64 for another summit with Khrushchev. So there, when I say the emergence of a great president, you could see the outlines of what he was going to do. He also took a number of steps during this period to several steps to reduce American involvement in Vietnam. Specifically, he announced the withdrawal of 1,000 advisors with a view to withdrawing all of them by the end of 65. So that's where that's what I, you know, saying. I would say he wasn't a great president at the time he was assassinated, but I believe that he all of the pieces were in place, and he intended to solve these problems and to become a great president. And given the fact of his life, of what he'd accomplished, the first Catholic to be elected to the White House, the youngest man ever elected president in the United States, a war hero in World War II who had failed several physical tests for the armed forces, and finally really just kind of lobbied and pushed his way into the Navy and then asked for a combat position. All of this speaks to the fact that Kennedy was somebody who usually accomplished what he set out to accomplish. And so I think the odds are good that he would have made great strides in ending the Cold War, and I think he eventually would have gotten the Civil Rights Bill, which was his Civil Rights Bill, through Congress.
So early in the book, you have a great quote where Jackie Kennedy, I think someone mentioned that JFK was a great politician, and she responded by saying, he may be a fine politician, but do we know if he's a fine person?
Right.
And in writing biographies, we spend a lot of time with our subjects. So I'm just curious, in all of your time of working on the life of JFK, have you reached any conclusions in that regard? What do you think of him as a person?
Well, I think he's a very complicated person. I think that he could be very cold to some people. He could be extremely warm. He was a surprisingly egalitarian man for someone who was as wealthy as he was, or someone who had had a valet to look after him ever since he'd been in college, really. In fact, the head of the Secret Service once said that of all of the presidents he'd known, including Truman, that John F. Kennedy was surprisingly the most egalitarian. So there are surprises in Kennedy. He of course had this voracious and somewhat twisted sexual appetite, and yet at the same time, while he was seeking sexual intimacy, he was somewhat standoffish and didn't like physical contact with other people. It was hard for him, the kind of handshaking, and you never see him putting his arm around people. He was never seen even holding hands with Jackie until after the death of their son, Patrick. So, but at the same time, I think he was also what Hugh Seide, who was the chief correspondent for Time magazine and knew Kennedy well and wrote a biography about him, once said after he died, that this was, despite the kind of personal life, the womanizing and everything else, that that Kennedy was basically a serious man on a serious mission. And that the at the heart of that mission, as Seide said and as others have said, was a determination to prevent a nuclear war and to keep the United States out of war. Robert McNamara, who would later counsel, of course, Lyndon Johnson, and Lyndon Johnson would take his advice on Vietnam, whereas Kennedy did not take McNamara or George Bundy or the other advisors of his who wanted him to send combat units to Vietnam. He refused to do it. McNamara said once that Kennedy believed that the main job of American president was to keep the United States out of war. And this belief came from Kennedy's experiences in World War II. I think the fact that his own brother had died and was killed in combat in the war, that this was his, he considered this mission. So the things that are extremely praiseworthy about Kennedy, that are very appealing about him, particularly compared to some of the men who followed him in the Oval Office, But at the same time, he has this kind of secret, this secret life, the life of the womanizer, that he kept from people. His health was also another of his secrets. What he did was, which makes him such a this all makes him such a fascinating subject for a biographer, because he had so many different compartments, Kennedy, and he put people in these compartments. Ted Sorensen was his closest one of his closest aide and speechwriter, but he never once invited Ted Sorensen to dinner upstairs at his quarters in the White House. Extraordinary. The same Ben Bradley, who was at the Washington Post and Newsweek, was invited up to the White House all the time for dinner with his wife. Kennedy wanted to relax with him, but Bradley had told me in several interviews, and I believe him, that he had no idea about Kennedy's womanizing. He had absolutely no clue. So all of this makes Kennedy, I think, a fascinating subject. And the way I tried, what I tried to do was to look into all of these compartments at the same time, not just to restrict myself to a book about the Kennedy the man, but also do Kennedy the man, his personal life, his Kennedy as president, Kennedy as politician. And by looking into all these compartments, trying to get a much more complete picture of Kennedy. Mm-hmm.
So we don't have as much time to talk about the book in depth as we usually do. So I wonder if, just to give our listeners a taste of what to expect, if you could discuss where the book opens and sort of walk us through the different prisms of that, with the death of Patrick Kennedy and the impact of that death on Kennedy's marriage, the presidency, and the man himself.
The death of his son was probably, it was an incredibly traumatic event for Kennedy. He wanted to have a large family. His brother Bobby, of course, had a huge family. It was their third child. They had had one previous. Jackie had had a miscarriage with their first child. And the baby came prematurely, 7 or 8 weeks prematurely. These days, if you had a baby that prematurely, they would probably survive. But then they didn't. It was 50-50. And he flew up to Cape Cod, where Jackie had gone into labor, and went to Children's Hospital. The baby was whisked up to a hospital in Boston and spent the next 36 hours with him, watching Patrick struggle to live, and was actually holding Patrick's hand when the baby died. This was incredibly, he burst into tears. He came back to Jackie's bedside and wept again at the funeral. He tried to carry the coffin in his arms out of the chapel, came back to Jackie and wept again, and finally said that they would have to watch their grief, that they couldn't let their grief harm the work they had, the work they had to do, that we have to do for the country, he said. And this use of "we" made a huge impression on Jackie, because he'd never talked that way before. Her mother said she was very, very impressed by this. Thought it was signaled a possible change in their relationship. And there's evidence that they did become much closer after Patrick's death. We see them holding hands for the first time in public. A lot of their friends noticed a change in their relationship. Jackie talked about it to her friends. So it's not just a kind of wishful thinking of people, wishing that they had a happier marriage, were about to have a happier marriage before Dallas happened. No, there was real stuff going on. He, for example, Kennedy rented a house in Newport for the summer of 1964 for a month, because he knew Jackie liked it there. She'd grown up in Newport. He didn't like it as much as his family place in Cape Cod, but he thought it would please her, and he was going to give it to her, announce it as a surprise, I believe, over Christmas. And it was that. We know from a recent memoir published by one of his, Jack Kennedy's mistresses, that after Patrick's death, although they had plenty of chance to resume their sexual relationship and travel together, that he never touched her and was not interested in having sex anymore after Patrick's death. So there was a lot going on in the personal relationship, and it stemmed, I think, began with this very traumatic event for both of them, but particularly for Kennedy.
Do you think that had an effect on the presidency?
Oh, I do. In several places, I try to show in the book the how the personal and the presidential life kind of interacted and influenced each other. Most specifically, in this case, I think it was about 10 days after the death of Patrick. Kennedy was up at the house they had rented up at Cape Cod near his parents' compound. And he was looking through all of the mail, the condolence letters that had come from friends, and his eyes were tearing up, and it was raining outside. He couldn't go out and sail or play golf, and Caroline was very upset by the baby's death and was acting up and sitting in his lap. Well, during this weekend, he got a request from Avril Harriman and other people at the State Department to respond to a telegram from Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., who was the new American ambassador in Saigon, had just arrived a day or two earlier. Lodge had been approached by some generals who were plotting to overthrow President Diem, and they wanted to know what the position of the United States would be. And basically, the telegram that Kennedy was asked to approve said that although we wouldn't help them, if they succeeded in the coup, we would recognize their government and work with them and support them. It was more or less a green light for the coup. And this was the kind of decision that Kennedy had learned after the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis, that the way to reach these kind of decisions is you want to get in a room with all your advisors and hash it out and have them argue and go back and forth. And but this time he was just so distracted by his grief that he approved the cable. It went out, and when he got back to Washington 2 days later, some of the other his advisors who hadn't been consulted were horrified, and he tried to undo the damage. He did to a certain extent, but in the end, 3 months later, there was a coup against Diem, and certainly proving this telegram at first had encouraged the generals and contributed to it.
So as the 50th anniversary of the assassination approaches next week, what do you see of JFK's legacy?
Well, the legacy, there's lots of aspects to it. The first legacy is perhaps that you and I wouldn't be speaking, and I wouldn't be here if he hadn't been president at the time of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The other presidents, just to quickly recap, you know, at the time when we realized that the Russians were putting nuclear missiles and installing them in Cuba, at the first meetings, everyone in the XCOM, the committee of advisors that Kennedy gathered, wanted to mount a preemptive attack, a military attack on the missile sites. What we didn't know, what they didn't know, was that these missiles were fully operational at the time, and that the Russian generals had the authority to launch retaliatory strikes with these missiles if they were attacked without even consulting Moscow. It almost certainly would have led to a nuclear exchange and to a wider nuclear war. So Kennedy was the only one who didn't want to do this, who refused to do it. He had incredible skepticism by then of the brass. He felt that the generals had misled him on the Cuban, Cuban Bay of Pigs operation. And he'd been a junior officer in World War II, and a lot of them had a somewhat jaundiced eye, at the generals. So he was very skeptical. He rejected the advice of Curtis LeMay, the chief of the Air Force, and others to mount an attack. In fact, Curtis LeMay accused him of being an appeaser and made reference to Munich at the time, but Kennedy held firm. So certainly one of the legacies is avoiding a nuclear war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. I think this also contributed to the mourning at the time. The several other things. One of the great legacies, of course, is by the fact that he won the presidency, that he was the first Catholic president. We can kind of forget now what a big deal it was to have a Catholic in the United States. I mean, there was tremendous opposition to him. Certainly, he probably lost more than he gained by being a Catholic. He won very narrowly. But what he did, his election kind of kicked the door open and behind him, other minorities in the United States who hadn't held various offices walked through it. And Kennedy encouraged this. He appointed, for example, he appointed the first Polish American to a cabinet position, John Grunowski. So I think there was that that business. Of course, the space program, the Apollo program, he launched the moon mission. But it very well might have been a joint mission if he'd lived. Also, the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson were almost entirely originally Kennedy programs. Medicare was a Kennedy bill. The Civil Rights Bill was a Kennedy bill. Would he have gotten them through? Probably not as quickly as Johnson, but I think the consensus is that he would have succeeded, probably a year later after the election. And the war on poverty. The war on poverty was a Kennedy idea. He had developed it with Walter Heller, his economic advisor, in 1963. It had been accelerated when Kennedy had read an article about appalling poverty in Appalachia and Kentucky in October, and had mounted an emergency program to get food and relief to the areas described in the New York Times article. And had told Heller, he plotted out what he called his attack on poverty. The day after Dallas, on November 23rd, Walter Heller goes to see Lyndon Johnson and fills him in on what Kennedy was planning to do about poverty. And Johnson asks him if he wants to go ahead with it. Johnson says, "I do want to go ahead with it, but let's call it the war on poverty instead of the attack on poverty." So there's, I think these are all, you know, certainly all aspects of his détente. And the another thing that's also often forgotten in this country is that Kennedy's revision of the Immigration and Naturalization Act. We had a terribly restrictive immigration laws. Went back to the 1920s. There were racial preferences for Northern Europeans. Only 100 Asians and Chinese and people from the subcontinent were allowed to immigrate to the United States every year. And it was an appalling act, and Kennedy proposed ending it with his 1963 act. He didn't have a chance to get it through Congress, but it was passed in 1965 as a memorial and tribute to Kennedy, pushed by Ted Kennedy through Congress. And it's one of the reasons that in the United States we have the multiracial society that we have today, why you see so many Indians and Asians have immigrated to the United States. It wasn't possible before Kennedy. So I think these are just some of the aspects of his legacy. Of course, everybody knows about the Peace Corps. But I think that's really less important than some of these other things.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us today about JFK's last 100 days. Any idea who you're going to be writing about next?
I'm next writing about five Americans who risked their lives to save their Vietnamese friends in the final days of the Vietnam War.
Oh, that sounds fascinating.
Yeah.
I've been talking today with Thurston Clark about JFK's last 100 days. I'm Oline Eaton. This is New Books in Biography. Thanks for listening.